Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
There's a lot going on that makes no sense to me. So then you have to ask yourself, are they stupid or are they, you know, controlled? And this is a purposeful detonation of the West to bring in some crisis that then can be managed through, you know, central bank digital currency, UBI, one world order, whatever you want to call it. You know, when you have decisions made that are that stupid that, you know, armchair analysts like you and I can figure this out in like 2 seconds, there's a plan, I think.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
In a world where Wall Street insiders and Washington cronies are rigging the game by printing trillions of fake money, running dark pools out of sight of the average investor, inflating bubbles, and priming the economy for the mother of all crashes, one man has been exposing the fraud with razor-sharp data, and that's Ed Dowd, powerhouse analyst who spent a decade at BlackRock as a portfolio manager, skyrocketing their growth equity fund from $2 billion, well, to a staggering $14 billion. He is now the founding partner of Finance Technologies, spelled P-H-I-N-A-N-C-E. Technologies, a macro alternative investment firm that's all about spotting the big picture risks and opportunities. Ed's authored the eye-opening book, Cause Unknown, diving into the data on demographic shifts and their massive economic fallout from the COVID and the COVID shots, of course. He and I got to know each other during that era. And he's here to break down the markets, the scams, the reckoning ahead. We got to talk about the big AI bubble. Welcome to Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Ed, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris. Good to see you. Yeah.
I want to start with this AI bubble. I mean, even the Wall Street Journal has this really complicated like flow chart where they're trying to explain all the circularity of the funding. And it just reminds me of, I think it got encapsulated in the last 2 days with Sam Altman on a podcast, is asked about $13 billion in revenue against $1.4 trillion of capital spending commitments, and he whiffed on it and just said, well, then sell your shares, which is not a good answer for a CEO. And then the next day went further and said, maybe the taxpayers should backstop the borrowings we want to do. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. 5 or 6 days ago, he goes on a podcast and declares that the revenue figure is low. They're making more money. And if you're so scared about us making money, short our theoretical shares that we haven't issued yet, which made no sense. He's talking about shorting a private company, which you can't do. So, you know, that, and then he was very arrogant and talked about how this is not a problem. And then 5 days later, he's asking for a government backstop, which is effectively a bailout. Let's just be honest. I've never seen a bailout before a crisis occurs. So this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
Well, it sounds like the oldest of all things. It's a bubble, right? And a bubble exists when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. So he's here talking about, oh, we're growing revenue really quickly, but he's using chips that basically have a 3-year depreciable cycle in the real world. But I know they put them for 6 years on the books. But still, there's no way by the time they get into their next capital chip replacement cycle, they're already behind. They're just going to keep accruing losses that will just pile into the future until they someday get recognized. Isn't that kind of how that works?
Yeah, that's basically how it works. And look, right now, their revenue is coming from subsidized subscribers. So people are paying, I think, $19 a month for ChatGPT. It's clearly not enough to cover all the expenses because if you know, God forbid they tried to raise those prices, people would, you know, just drop the subscription. And corporate America has done AI pilots, and the studies are coming through from Yale and MIT that they're seeing no benefit. So the corporations aren't going to be doing big, giant licensing deals just yet. So there's this gap of revenue to investment that isn't going to come to fruition. It's classic. It's just like the dot-com bubble and the railroad bubble. There's a lot of infrastructure being built, a lot of speculation on hype and overbuilding, and a lot of that investment's going to, you know, go the way of the dodo bird, go to zero. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but the only problem with this AI bubble is, unlike the railroad, you had infrastructure after the bubble burst that then, you know, produced economic windfalls down the road. The dot-com bubble produced dark fiber that eventually was lit and produced the ability of Apple to, you know, sell a smartphone, Google, Facebook, all these companies, Web 2.0 companies that rose from the ashes, and Amazon benefited as well. The problem with this bubble is this technology, you know, it depreciates to zero, and, you know, I don't know, maybe there's some benefit, but it's going to be, I think a lot of this money is going to be torched and never really be useful.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, what do you have? You have data centers with some very massive compute power in them, and then you've got these models that basically exist in resident memory. So they need power. They need to be on 24/7, 365. There's no like 5 minutes out for these things. I think you have to reset the data center when that happens. So what do we really have at the end of the day with AI? What do we got?
We got a souped up search engine at the moment. I'm not saying AI isn't a real thing. I'm just saying it's not ready for prime time. And what we got is a, you know, souped up search model with a 25% hallucination/error rate. And when I first got on AI, I used Grok. I was impressed. But then over time, as I became familiar with it, I started to realize it wasn't as accurate as I thought. So now, after abandoning Google, I now have to do an AI. I ask a question in AI. And then, you know, sometimes they're simple questions, but if they're more complicated, then I have to go to Google and verify, make sure that the facts that AI is spitting me is correct. So it actually takes more time now. And you know, they're finding the same thing with code. They thought they could write code with AI, but now they're finding they have to go back and fix it. And at the end, the whole thing becomes a time-wasting endeavor for serious supposed savings.
Yeah, so I've had the same experience, Ed. I also like to use Grok. I use Grok Heavy. And if it's an area I know something a lot about, like let's say these magic holy shot injuries, right? It's just not even remotely in the same camp as what I know to be true. And I've caught it making stuff up, citing studies that don't actually exist, but basically hewing to consensus. And of course, I don't need a consensus function in my life. I'm trying to figure out what's true, and the consensus is not true right now in most areas. So that's been my problem with it so far.
Well, let's think about Wall Street. You know, you're a finance guy. We're all about, you know, trading against consensus if we find something that makes the consensus theory false. And that's how people have made fortunes and great investments, is bucking consensus. So AI, if AI is just nothing more than consensus, there is an asymmetric opportunity to arb that, you know, going forward. So I think there's going to be a need for human research that's never going to change, because AI is just basically current conventional wisdom, which is not always right and sometimes very wrong. And, everyone says AI is going to, you know, get rid of human analysis. I actually think it's going to make it more valuable over time once people realize AI is wrong a lot.
Well, some of the most valuable human analysis in times past has been McKinsey consultants. And I know that some irony that McKinsey burned through 100 billion tokens or something like that. They are the number one powerhouse user of ChatGPT.
So here we go. McKinsey and the consultants, that whole industry was built upon basically ratifying a decision the CEO has already made to give them cover. Most of their money is made coming up and reverse engineering the CEO's decision and say, look, the consultant said it was okay. So if it goes wrong, it was the consultant's fault.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. How do you see the bubble in AI, if we can call it a bubble? I mean, it's comprehensive, right? You got NVIDIA and its $5 trillion so-called market capitalization around that. You got your OpenAIs. You've got the data center providers. There's a lot of companies in this. Where do you see this the detonation happening?
Well, so let's look at the stock market. I mean, the current stock market indices have been floated the last several months by AI. Seven stocks are producing most of the returns. So the asset management world, you know, if you're an asset manager and you're a portfolio manager, you have to chase, you know, it's harder and harder to beat your benchmarks. So you crowd ever more of your money into those stocks. Hedge funds have to do the same thing. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy until it isn't. And so NVIDIA is a $5 trillion market cap, I believe, at the moment. It's more, it's larger market capitalization than the whole Nikkei index. So you have to ask yourself, stepping back, what is a semiconductor company at the end of the day? It's a cyclical company that produces chips that then depreciate fast because there's always new iterations of the chips, and they're at their base level a commodity. So 40,000 GPUs, just when you step back from the mania, are ultimately a commodity at some point. So there'll be more competition. There already is. The AI companies are already talking about building their own chips. So, you know, $40,000 GPUs aren't sustainable. So NVIDIA, number one, is not going to be at a $5 trillion market cap 2-3 years from now. It's going to be a lot lower. So there you go on just NVIDIA alone. The revenue model for OpenAI, which is a user of NVIDIA chips, doesn't seem to be anytime going to make an ROI on the current situation, the power consumption, the chip prices. So they're not going to make an ROI. There's no way. Someone did a calculation. I saw it that the most successful AI, the most successful subscription model is Office 360, right? That's $96 billion in annual revenue. So so for OpenAI and the AI ecosystem to make money, given the current projected investments they need, you get a 10% ROI. They're going to need something like $900 billion in subscription revenue, 10 times bigger than Microsoft's, the most successful product ever. And then in addition, the hyperscalers are going to need another trillion in revenue at 25% margin. So the whole thing doesn't work. The math isn't mathing. So one of a few things has to happen. Prices have to come down. Compute power prices have to come down. And, you know, one of the big things about DeepSeek that people kind of, you know, forgot about, that came out, I think, in first quarter of this year, they have to figure out a way to do it for like a fraction of cost of compute power. That's what is going to happen. So it seems to me that the U.S. has decided in this bubble to chase CapEx rather than efficiency, and that's where it's going to end up going. I mean, we're going to be able to do AI much cheaper at some point in the future.
Well, China's obviously up to its eyeballs in this, obviously, with the DeepSeek, but also they're pushing hard. From what I can gather, they seem to be pursuing a more pragmatic approach, which is how can we wrap this into our manufacturing processes, which I think there's probably some legit business case there. We'll see how it shakes out. But AI is fundamentally a story of electricity, and China produces 2.5 times as much electricity as the United States and is already putting in nuclear, more dams, and all kinds of stuff. So if this story is a foot race that's going to be delimited in some way by your access to electricity, I think China's already won the race.
We just launched a China report that we're selling to institutions. It's not cheap. So, you know, if you're a retail investor, don't bother looking at the price. But it's a very comprehensive deep dive into China and the challenges facing China. And you are correct. They overbuilt to such an extent that their internal, and they have a demographic bomb going off. They have decades worth of real estate investment, and they have overbuilt all manners of industrial and, you know, power infrastructure. So they have the power to absorb for AI should it be there, because the demographics are going the wrong way. Having said that, China is facing, you know, an existential crisis, and their internal consumption and demand is plummeting due to demographics. So that's why they need to export more, and that's why we're having trade wars right now. They, unfortunately, again, I love when people say they're, you know, they plan for 100 years and they're so smart. Well, if they were so smart, they wouldn't have built 20 years worth of housing inventory, which is going to torch their internal industrial demand. So what do you do with that internal industrial capacity? You export that to keep the engines of growth going. So that's what we're facing, a deflationary bomb from China. And that's why we have tariffs. That's why every nation in the world should be concerned. China is in existential crisis due to their overbuild and their malinvestment. But you are right. They have the power infrastructure to absorb AI. We don't. They do.
So I'm wondering, what do you think about this idea? I have this idea that occurs to me from every so often, where I know that we have this FASAB 56, which allows the government to hide any spending it doesn't want people to know about, as long as it's in the interest of national security, right? And we know that some, who was it that made it most completely? I think it was the Ag Secretary. But anyway, we've had these it was the Interior Secretary, that's right, making these ideas that you know, AI is an existential threat. There's this digital canyon. Either we get there first or China gets there first, and whoever gets there first dominates the other forever. Do you think there's any credence to the idea that that these mysteriously robust earnings and revenues being supported by the top seven already have some government money wrapped in there?
Well, if you look at what's going on with their free cash flow, it's going the wrong way. So they may be getting some money, but not enough to cover what's going on. If you look underneath the hood, free cash flow is going lower. Free cash flow is ultimately, you know, what we look at in investments. Earnings can be manufactured for a period of time. And the same thing happened in the dot-com bubble. That earnings were manufactured through accounting gimmicks and you know, vendor financing. But there was a period when I realized Nortel's days were over. They reported record revenues, record earnings, and if you looked at the free cash flow, it was zero. So we're now hitting free cash flow problems because when you're investing this amount of money and capital, it sucks up the cash, and this is what's going on. The amount of money they're investing is not returning. There's no return on investment, so the cash flows are going lower, and that ultimately will curb all this. And if you look at Oracle's CDS, they're trying to issue a bunch of debt to fund data centers. The CDS, I mean, it's still relatively low, but it's going the wrong direction. Their credit default swaps are rising, and that's an indication that the debt market's going to take so much before they demand a return. And we're getting closer to that point. And I really think what the big message that might have been lost in the last 24-hour period from Sam Altman and his CFO asking for a government backstop, and NVIDIA at the same time saying China has already won, which is clearly a ploy to get Trump to give them money. They just admitted that the financing has gotten tighter and that there's a demand issue, a revenue issue. So they just admitted the fundamental degradation without really saying it has arrived. So if I was and I just put out a post on this on X, if I was still a large cap growth manager at BlackRock, you know, I'd be up to my eyeballs in these AI stocks, waiting for the market to tell me when to get out. Well, I just got a signal from the two big players that there's fundamental degradation, there's financing issues behind the scenes, and I would be putting, you know, the stock, both, you know, I have CoreWeave and NVIDIA down today. OpenAI is now public. I would be putting shares on the desk to at least get underweight my benchmark, because they just signaled to me that the end is near.
And speaking of the end is near signs, you mentioned earlier, I think before we started recording, that a few Hindenburg omens had been spotted. What is a Hindenburg omen for people listening, and how do they get triggered?
Basically, it's a day where the market is green, but there's a certain percent of issues hitting new 52-week lows. And what it denotes is that the indices look fine because they're green and they're rising, but underneath the hood, there's a lot of the market that's, you know, rolling over, and so the market is being carried by fewer and fewer stocks. And you know, if you're into physics and laws of nature, that doesn't last that long. If, you know, gravity eventually takes hold.
Well, then the market structure under that is extra rotten or thin, right? So when we had the housing bust, sure, you know, we lost some mortgage insurers and mortgage companies and some home builders and all that, but everything else was kind of okay-ish under that. So there was sort of a bed to capture that. What are we looking at right now? We're seeing October had the largest Challenger and Gray layoff announcement since 2003. We're seeing Chipotle say earnings are down. We're seeing DoorDash saying, uh-oh, they just had a big hiccup. We're seeing lots and lots of signs that the consumer is finally tapped out at this point in time, which is normal. Recessions happen. But that's all being sort of covered up because the big seven, the big five, whatever, keep going up.
Yeah, for the time being, and that won't last. This always ends. The other problem we have is another columnist asked since the beginning of the year, is the housing recession coming? And that's definitely coming. All our indicators are rolling over. The marginal support to the housing market was the 20 million people we dropped into the country over the prior three to 4 years. They supported rents, and rents feed into home prices, and that's going the wrong way. New tenant rents are dropping. The illegal immigration flow has been stopped. Deportations aren't that many. There's been mostly self-deportations, but we got a warning sign that my thesis on illegal immigration really kind of propping up the economy in 23 and 24 was correct. We saw three events happen pretty quickly. We saw Tricolor Auto, which is a subprime lender, mostly to illegal immigrants. That one just bankrupt, happened fast. First Brands, which is a aftermarket auto parts dealer, they obviously were, you know, they couldn't hold together their fraud and their scheming because the incremental demand disappeared from the illegal immigrants. And then Primaland, another subprime auto lender, went bankrupt. So this is, and I'm hearing anecdotally that people in the South were, you know, they were kind of saying my thesis of immigration was kind of stupid. Now they're saying, no, you were right. We're seeing things roll over quite quickly in the housing market, especially closer to the border.
I think you were exactly right. And I wasn't skeptical of it, but I had to think on it for a minute. So like, I never thought about that mass wave of 20 million people flooding in, being given all kinds of support. But I was shocked to find in the case of Primaland that they were lending to people without social security numbers or any credit history. That's how crazy it had gotten. I didn't realize we'd gotten that far.
Correct. And I'm sure we're going to find that out also in the housing market. There were probably some homes bought by illegals with no credit, nothing. You got to remember that, you know, when you bring 20 million people in, I mean, we it's a lot of people, and it happens super fast. And they were given all sorts of government goodies. And there was an ecosystem around this illegal logistical willful operation done by the government. And we were running 8% deficits. So we still don't have a handle on how much of our treasure was given to these people that then they turned around and put back into the economy in the form of grocery spending, goods spending. You know, if you came from Guatemala and you came and you were given, a social security number and some handouts and some SNAP benefits and some rental income, any money you got, you immediately spent because you never had money in your life. So the multiplier effect on illegal immigrant is much higher than Joe Sixpack. And, you know, even with all that juice, and we've estimated, you know, between what the government agencies get directly and what was washed through the NGOs, which is also, we know about the NGOs, that's just a washing mechanism for fraud. We've estimated anywhere from $500 billion to $1.5 trillion was pumped into the economy during the Biden administration, and that went straight into the, you know, into the corporations' profits and pockets. And if you look at consumer facing corporations, a lot of them are down 30-40% this year. These stocks are not doing well. Underneath the AI euphoria, the rest of the stock market is slowly rolling over, and home builders are rolling over, regional banks are rolling over, consumer facing goods companies are down on the year quite a bit. And we're just waiting for the masses to figure out when they look at their 401k statements in February, March, and April of next year, they'll be quite shocked. And that's when the real selling begins, because that's how that works. People buy high and sell low. That's just the way the psychology works.
Yeah, Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, that's why I think we both do what we do. I'd like more people to avoid that if possible. But here's the definition of a bubble. By definition, more than half of the people can't get out of it. It's just the nature of the beast, right? It's there's not much you can do about that, right? So the people who do, there are people who do fine during bubbles, right? The people during the South Sea bubble, somebody backed up their cart and took livres out of the National Bank in France in exchange for their South Sea shares or whatever, right? Some people do okay, but the majority get burnt. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, the bubble grows on, all bubbles are created via credit. People borrowed, margin up. And then when it unwinds, it happens so fast that they're over levered, they get margin called out, lose all their profits. We're seeing that in Bitcoin right now. And then the other people, psychologically, a lot of them binary at the tops. So they don't want to sell when it's down a little bit because they think the bubble hasn't ended. And then they watch it. You know, I know people have rode .com stocks down 90% and then finally gave up at the lows. That's another psychological pitting. But the problem with the bubble is most people buy at the top. By the time the general public is aware of the situation, it is a bubble and it's the end because the insider is selling to the retail investors.
Well, there's this other psychological dynamic which mystifies me. People get really sloppy towards the end. So there's that awesome email, I think it was with First Brands, where they're like, hey, do these collateral receivables, do they actually exist? They're like, no. Right? And then we also saw at the top of this, we saw BlackRock get scammed for $500 million in a telecom thing. Again, failing to do some pretty basic due diligence.
Due diligence goes the way of the dodo bird because... at the end, in a bubble, it's not so much let's cross our T's and dot our I's. It's can I get access to the deal? So people are scrambling, and you to get a seat at the table to get access to the deal, you have to like oversize your ask. So if you really want $100 million, you have to ask for $300 million, and then maybe you get it becomes a feeding frenzy, and due diligence goes out the window, and. Look, I thought it was ridiculous when I was hearing last year, this is like 12, 18 months ago, that private equity was financing a lot of these data center deals with NVIDIA chips as collateral. And I said to myself, you're using rapidly depreciating chips as collateral. That makes zero sense. You're using a commodity product as collateral. It was insanity.
Well, they don't always ring a bell, but sometimes they give you lots of little scratching noises to look at. I mean, this is, it's obviously a huge thing, but how did we get here? So I'm curious just to know like how we got here, because October 2023, stocks are rolling over, they're tripping all kinds of momentum and technical indicators, and all of a sudden, middle of the night, I kid you not, November 1st, futures just goes the other way. And we've been this way ever since. And all these financial indicators tell me there's a huge blob of money out there. And it's not just U.S., right? The German DAX is doing this. We're seeing this in the Nikkei. Somebody unleashed a massive amount of liquidity into the system. Where did that come from?
So people have been watching M2, and people think I believe the M2 rising lately over the last year and a half, 2 years, was not the Federal Reserve printing money. It's what happens in the end of a large credit cycle. That's Ponzi credit. So that's actual private credit creation. That is basically at the end of the day, it's debt created to backstop prior debt or pay interest on debt with the promise of future, returns. And the market at some point will say no mas, and that Ponzi credit will all go to zero. But I truly believe. When the system figured out that the U.S. government was going to spend one and a half, and again, it wasn't like people were told, but liquidity started pouring into the market in October of 23, because that's when I think the Biden administration really opened the floodgates to NGOs. And you got to remember, a lot of the illegals came in starting in 23, 24. And that's when the markets, the banks... liquidity felt better because they were, you know, people were getting checks into their NGOs. The NGOs would then go into the stock market. There was a lot of stock market speculation by that. So it wasn't a plan. It was just a flooding of the U.S. with deficit spending to support the illegal alien operation. And Trump has at least stopped that. So, that's why I said a recession was coming. Trump's policies were going to cause it. Unfortunately, his ego has gotten him to the point where he decided to back the AI bubble, which is going to burst on his watch. And he didn't have it. You know, they had an opportunity in January and February to sit down with the American people and say, these are the policies we're going to do. They're going to bring back jobs. It'll take time because of negotiations on tariffs and breaking of ground. In the meantime, we're coming off this sugar high juice of illegal immigration, and there's going to be ramifications. But, you know, just stick with us. But no, now they're going to own it. Unfortunately, they're going to own it.
Well, I was pretty excited when Doge started ripping through using AI to sort of pierce through all the bureaucratic layers that they thought were impenetrable. Nobody will ever figure out our budgets. And that was pretty exciting. But then they pulled the plug on that. And so they said, nah, we're not going to do, we're just going to do top line growth. We're going to grow the economy, which every president, you know, that's what they ultimately default to, I guess. But I didn't see the plan for how the economy was going to grow necessarily. Because AI could help on one hand, but it's deflationary on the other. You need cheap energy, so we're okay there as a country, but electricity costs are starting to spike, so that's getting a little painful. But ultimately, the only way you're going to really get, I think, a resumption of any kind of industry here in the U.S. is you have to slash the regulations and the red tape.
I agree, and I thought that was coming, and we haven't seen that yet, unfortunately. The plan... Something needs to be done about China. And so the idea of tariffs, while I've come to the conclusion they're deflationary overall, is that something needs to be done. We can't have China dumping excess capacity into the global markets. It'll just devastate and wreck economies for years to come. And you have to reshore manufacturing. So it's a good idea in theory, but the problem is, as you know, it doesn't happen overnight. So Trump got all excited about these headline deals. Oh, Japan has committed $500 billion in investments in the U.S. Well, that's all dandy, but you got to remember, if you go into the details underneath the press releases, the Japanese trade deal still needs to be ratified by their own parliament, so that hasn't happened yet. The $500 billion isn't going to, like, come here tomorrow. This is long-term planning and breaking up ground, and there's a valley between the hangover from the Biden fraud, and they had an opportunity to communicate that to the American people. They could have had a double dip recession right before the midterms, like Ronald Reagan did, but they didn't. Now they're now claiming it's the greatest economy ever. And you know, you're on X, I'm on X. You know, people that wouldn't normally call BS on Trump or call him BS on Trump because it's such blatant gaslighting. It's comical, and you know. You can't be taken seriously as anybody who comments on anything on X without recognizing how ridiculous of a statement they're making about the economy. It's the golden age. It's absurd.
Well, it might be for them if they only hang out with 0.1%ers. It's probably pretty good times, you know.
Yeah, it must be. But I mean, all you have to do is like pop on Twitter or look at the stock market other than the top seven, and you can figure out and look at the job number. I mean, they have access to the job numbers. The job numbers are going the wrong way. And inflation's coming down. And inflation's coming down. Inflation coming down is good, but not at the end of a credit cycle. And inflation coming down is actually, you know, a sign that the growth is slowing quite quickly. And one of the biggest components of the CPI is shelter, which is 36%. So we're going to see a sub 2% CPI number sometime in the next 12 months, maybe by the end of the year. And it's going to be due to the shelter component. And that's that, you know, when you get deflation and shelter, that affects banks and credit, and the feedback loops are not nice.
Well, I've been thinking that we may be mirroring, I think it was, who was that? Zoltan? At Apollo said, hey, you know, history doesn't always repeat exactly. Sometimes it rhymes, but we had that double hump inflation in the 70s from 73 to 78 and then 79 to 82. And that was driven by bad monetary policy and energy spikes. I think we could see an energy spike here for reasons, and it's based on a very fundamental deep analysis I do on natural gas, supply and demand, all that. That's one place I think consensus has it wrong, because I'm looking at flat output for the last year and billions and billions of cubic feet per day of demand for LNG and data centers just piled up. Anyway, different story. But if we get that sort of, I think we could get that set up. And I think that we're looking at a place where the Federal Reserve is going to be forced to print again to avoid calamity, or they're going to see it that way. What do you think?
I think that's coming, and then we'll have another round of inflation. But before then, we're going to get deflation and credit destruction. This is usually confusing for a lot of people. During the Great Financial Crisis, you probably remember oil went to like 180 or 160, something crazy in June of 2008. The inflation prints were accelerating June, July, August, and then everything just went the wrong way. This is coming. They're going to print, or we're going to get another round of inflation. But before then, we're going to get deflation, hopefully in home prices, because honestly, if you're asking why the mayor in New York was elected, young people voted him in. They feel like they haven't had a fair shake. They're not participating in the capitalist system because they don't own anything. Home prices going down and taking out a lot of over-levered players may be, scary, and the economy will, there'll be layoffs. But ultimately, you want to fix and make sure capitalism is popular again, get people into owning their own assets. And home prices right now, it can't be done. Just can't. For people that are first-time home buyers, it doesn't happen. The average age has climbed to like 40. It's ridiculous. The most of the people buying homes are boomers selling homes between themselves. Millennials can't get in. It's a generational problem.
Well, I think that I'm no political sharpie, but, I observe because I think it has effects on markets, and I'd like to know if the Trump administration continues on their current plan. I think they're a little tone deaf. They're missing the fact that they've alienated a lot of people, especially the young people, and I think maybe we had early insights into that in this current voting that happened in New York and Virginia. Okay. If they end up losing the midterms and the Democrats take control back, I think Trump goes down as Hoover, because the Democrats are going to be in no mood to do anything other than be obstructionist and block everything. And I think that's that. And what do you think?
Yeah, there's a Hoover chance coming. And that's why I put out a memo to the White House yesterday.
Did you?
I said, because they were talking about the great stock market. And I said, no one cares about 7 AI stocks while the rest of the market implodes, and you are going to face a Hoover moment unless you change the messaging and or focus. I mean, talking about a great stock market in this economy, that 7 AI stocks it's absurd, and it's not going to work. So I agree with you. There's a Hoover moment coming unless they pull a 180 and start focusing on domestic issues, real problems, and stop this this gaslighting, because it's not working, frankly. I mean, look, we all laughed at the Biden gaslighting, and I'm sorry, I call balls and strikes. I'm gonna laugh at this gaslighting. It's absurd. The housing market is rolling over. We're gonna have a recession without even an AI bubble bursting, but now we're gonna have an AI bubble bursting and a housing recession. It's going to be very difficult. And if they don't change their messaging and focus and start to lay the blame on where, the blame is due, they're going to lose the midterms badly. The other thing I wanted to point out, a lot of people talk about the 70s inflation being the same as this current regime we're in. The one difference that I want to point out is in the 70s, we had a demographic boom of the boomers moving into the workforce, and we don't have that now. We don't have a boom a lot of the prices that we see are artificial in the housing market. They were prepped. During COVID, I'm sure you saw the Federal Reserve bought trillions of dollars of MBS. And they bought them off the bank's balance sheet to inject liquidity. What did the banks do? They went out and lent more money. So that's why we had a housing boom. right after the COVID fiasco. When unfortunately, and also because of illegal immigration, our numbers show that we overbuilt multi-tenant structures. These are units of five units or more, to the tune of bigger than the 70s boom. So the boomers graduated from college, moved into apartments, then they eventually bought single-family homes. But in the 70s, we had a multi-unit build-out, the likes of which we haven't seen since. Well, we just exceeded that in the last couple of years. So there's going to be, you're going to see rents below home prices for some time to come. And eventually that, for homes to be able to be sold, that has to, homes need to get cheaper than rents. That's coming. And that, the way that's going to happen is price. And there's going to be a lot of people that, you know, are going to be benefiting from that on the buy side. But those who are over levered are going to be taken to the woodshed. All the Airbnb speculators, they're done. That's in motion. I live on Maui. There's tons of people who bought these properties. They outbid locals because the math worked at the time. And they thought they're going to have these rental incomes. And guess what? That's going to not happen.
Hmm. Now, tacking on top of that, I don't know if you saw, but I've interviewed a gentleman named Mitch Vexler a couple of times, and he sort of exposed this property tax fraud. It started in his home county in Texas. He's a developer, and he noted that their methodology that they're supposed to follow from the assessor standpoint was not being followed. So he scratched and dug, and what he found was just an unbelievable amount of fraud and waste and all that. So quick example, Denton County, which I drive through to go to my friend Jeff's ranch up north of Fort Worth, it's cows, it's single and double wides. I think the average family income is like 63,000 or something. It's not, you know, not all that. They have something like $100 billion of debt on that county. Now, Texas counties are big, and almost all of that is school debt because they have these rocking football stadiums for their little, you know, Div 3 scrub team, right, hopefuls. But at any rate, there's not a chance. He said it's as if every single household in Denton County had a $1.9 million mortgage on it above what they already owe, because that's what it's going to take to pay it back. And that's all collateralized with the real estate property taxes that are levied upon those homes. Long story made endless, it doesn't math. It can never be paid back.
Yes. So I don't know if you remember, right after the great financial crisis, there were a lot of smart hedge fund managers who thought there was going to be a municipal bond crisis next. Remember that? Well, mm-hmm. What they didn't count on was a couple things. Interest rates went to zero and stayed there for a long, long time. And the federal government became a bigger and bigger part of I think at the great financial crisis, 70% of all public debt was federal and 30% was local. By the time COVID hit, it was 90% federal, 10% local. So what that meant was the federal government was using their credit rating to subsidize a lot of these states and local municipalities. So these people have gotten fat off of government largesse, and some of them have, you know, not all of them, but some of them have done what you just outlined is, you know, issued $100 billion in debt, and they're never going to be able to pay it back, and it's going to be a disaster. And so maybe the Muni crisis is another thing we have to think about at some point.
Well, if house prices start falling, you're going to see a lot of people filing for abatements, and, you know, because the trick that they use, like I live in a Prop 2.5 state, so allegedly my property taxes can't go up by more than 2.5% in any given year. But that's just the rate that, so the way they get around that is they assess your house a lot higher and apply the same rate to it. And so we've seen property taxes going up by 5, 6, 7%, 7% nationally, higher than that in some locations. And that's a compounding problem. So those, it's 7%, rule of 72, every 10 years, your property taxes double. And obviously this is eating in a big, big way, but I don't know how to solve that. And if there's falling house prices, I could really see this turning into a hot mess there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's going to be a lot of hot messes. The rule of 72 is odious. People don't understand that. It's you know, what is it? 15%. It doubles every 5 years, 7%, 10, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And look, the fundamental problem with the average consumer is this: they don't make up their wages have not kept up with inflation, so they have a grocery problem. You throw on top of that a healthcare problem because of COVID and all the disabilities and death and destruction that's going on. Everybody's raising insurance costs, so they can't afford healthcare anymore. And then you have property taxes. Then you have insurance on your home. Insurance costs have gone up. The whole fixed cost of like just being in the world is at the point where everything discretionary is getting torpedoed. So, you know, going out to a restaurant, no go. And that's what we're seeing. McDonald's is seeing people not able to go to McDonald's. When does that ever happen? Not often. And we're at the end, and again, that's why the Trump administration is so tone deaf. If they lived in the shoes of the average $50,000 a year person, these people, you know, they got hope when he was elected, but they have seen nothing since. Nothing. Nothing's changed for them. Not a thing.
Well, surely bombing Venezuela will help.
To get the oil, because I don't care about the. I mean, if they didn't have any oil, would we care about Venezuela?
No.
I don't think so. I just don't think so. And you know, I shy away from talking about anything Israel, but that's a constant distraction. The European Union wants to drag us into war with Russia because their solution to what's happening to them with their pension system basically bankrupt is. They need to go to war. So if you follow anybody who's into the war scene, the statements coming out of these governments and their actions they're gearing up for war. And you know how that works. When you get the bureaucracy gearing up for something, it usually erupts at some point. So it wouldn't shock me at all to see at least a conventional European war. Maybe it goes tactical nuke. I don't know. But the debt and demographic problems are coming to a head. They just are.
Well, and Europe is my poster child for if you want to peer into the future, just look at Germany, right? So they shot themselves in the energy foot, right? The Nord Stream pipeline, they didn't make a peep. They dismantled their own nukes. That's on them. They put in very expensive solar and wind, and it's a very gray country on average. So anyway, bad ideas. But even with all of that, they now have years of data in front of them. Their energy intensive industries have crashed more than at the depths of the Great Depression. We're down 26% from just 4 or 5 years ago, and it's crashing. And their solution is to do a little bit more of the same and send some more money to Ukraine. I've never seen anything this illogical in my life.
You know, you have to ask yourself, is it on purpose? Because there's a lot going on that makes no sense to me, Chris, and I'm sure it does to you as well. So then you have to ask yourself, are they stupid or are they, you know, controlled? And this is a purposeful detonation of the West to bring in some crisis that then can be managed through, you know, central bank digital currency, UBI, one world order, whatever you want to call it. It's when you have decisions made that are that stupid, that, you know, armchair analysts like you and I can figure this out in like 2 seconds. There's a plan, I think.
Yeah. Well, it took me a little while to wrap my head around that under COVID, because at first I was like, how can they be this stupid? But when they flip the coin and it comes up heads 50 times in a row, like every decision was the wrong decision, right? Eventually you have to understand that it's either a two-headed coin or, some other fraud is being committed. Like the point wasn't to create public health. The point was to lock people down, instill them with fear, get them, you know, injected with this new thing that they were so eager to get into everybody for some reason. And we're still seeing that the long-term impacts of that, obviously, it's devastating by the statistics at this point. Birth rates, cancer rates, disabilities. It's just it's stunning that we can't even have an honest conversation still about that.
No, look, I think Bobby Kennedy is doing the best he can. He hasn't changed, but he's not the boss, and he's, you know, in a hostile environment in the bureaucracy. Same with Jay Bhattacharya. They're doing the best they can, but the buck stops with Trump. He's the chief, and his inadmission, his ability to not admit what happened with the vaccines, and to praise Pfizer and to have Larry Ellison in there talk about mRNA cancer vaccines. That's also another problem for him as well. A lot of people voted for him because of Bobby and Maha, and the fact that Maha hasn't really tackled the vaccine issue, and at least on the mRNA side, I don't think it's the fault of Bobby or Maha. I think it's that's the director from on high. Is you can go only so far, but no further. And until we have a national reconciliation and some of these people who did this are put in jail, that's another lingering issue besides the economic disaster that's coming. So Trump has to pull a 180 on a bunch of things: vaccines, mRNA vaccines, and his economic policy and talking points. Because talking about how great the economy is just, I mean, it's patently absurd. Just patently absurd.
Well, I actually agreed with, I think it was Dave Smith said it, because I didn't realize it at the time. I had a lot of, I wanted to give Trump all the benefit of the doubt, right? And of the five basic platforms that are out there, I'm giving him various grades between D and F for you know where we are. And I get it. It's harder than it looks, and you're up against the deep state, right, and the swamp and all that. But the moment he said the Epstein files are a hoax, we all know that's not true, right? And that was just a too much, too far for me moment. I think that was a breaking moment, I think, for a lot of people in what you'd call MAGA or whatever, who were kind of hoping that things would be different. That's more of the same right there.
I agree. And so then the thesis was put forward by many. Well, they've decided to not release it because they're using it as blackmail to control the deep state. And I said, look, if you're going to use evil means to do this and basically cover up the crimes that these people did to blackmail them, you're no better than the other people. I'm sorry, I have a moral problem with that. We do not protect pedophiles and child murderers or whatever is going on, human traffic, and we do not protect that. We do not use that. Oh, we're not in power, we're going to use the same methods that the other administration. No, that's not happening. Mm-hmm. So even if that's this thesis, it doesn't work for me. So then the question is, what's going on? And, you know, I think a lot of people, Trump has been doing a good job of losing a lot of his base step by step. He lost a lot of people on that. He lost a lot of people in Maha with the mRNA. Not everybody, but
lost
a lot of people.
The farmers.
Yeah, the farmers. Now he's losing Wall Street because, you know, he's, you know, I know a lot of guys on Wall Street who love Trump, but they're like, how can you be talking about how great the economy is? And he's, you know, excited about a stock market that everybody is in agreement is a bubble and they're just waiting to burst it and short it on the other side. No, I'm not. That's the thing about bubbles. You don't try to short it. You wait until it pops, then you can short the hell out of it. So do not short this, then, is my recommendation to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Just avoid the storm. Have low volatile assets like cash, T-bills, and wait for, you know, do what Warren Buffett's going to do. Wait for the bargains. You do not want to make money shorting this thing. It could go up another 20% from here, especially if Trump backs OpenAI. We don't know.
Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions.
So if you're, you know, they say every bubble's in search of a pin, or maybe a hedgehog full of pins, but where are you looking? Are you watching the headline indices? Are you watching subcomponents? Are you watching credit? Are you watching junk debt? What do you watch to give you early warning signs?
Yeah, I'm watching credit. And let's look at the U.S. Treasury market, especially the long end, the 10-year and the 30-year. And let's also look at the U.S. dollar. I follow Cycles work by Tim Wood. He's very good at cycles. The 3-year Treasury has a 3-year cycle. The 30-year Treasury has a 3-year cycle, U.S. dollar, 4-year cycle. They're converging and putting in major lows recently, and now they're starting to slowly, steadily go up, which says to me that risk-taking on the margin is evaporating. So that the U.S. dollar going up is a sign of credit destruction and dollar liquidity shortages across the globe, which makes sense. These tariffs are creating dollar liquidity issues. And risk off on the margins is coming off. The U.S. Treasury market, let's look at the 10-year. When we issued our report that a recession was coming, the 10-year is at 480. It's now 415, but it's going lower. And once the understanding that the jobs are going the wrong way and the economy is going the wrong way, there's going to be a moment where the Fed chases and T-bonds and 10-year notes and whatnot are going to add a tremendous appreciation. So that's, I watch those. They're already giving you the warning signs. For the stock market, the Hindenburg omens don't help. I think yesterday's nonsense with Sam Altman and NVIDIA admitting that they are basically out of money. This may be the pop. Trump may come in and bail this out, but we're close. And we're in the end games. We're looking at credit spreads are starting to slowly creep up. Regional banks are rolling over. That's a subcomponent. Home builders are rolling over. So everything says to me, it's not 6 to 12 months from now. It's within a 6-month window that it becomes apparent to everyone the stock market's done.
And do you track Bitcoin at all? I have, because it's sort of my preferred liquidity gauge.
Yeah, you are dead spot on. Bitcoin is a liquidity gauge. Nothing against Bitcoin, but it is not a store of value. It is a 95% correlated asset to the NASDAQ, and it usually has been pretty good of indicating liquidity problems by a couple of weeks, and Bitcoin just started rolling over, and it's struggling to go to new highs. We had that issue with the altcoins. The altcoin community was wiped out a couple weeks ago. So you can see, you can feel it. You can see, if you've been doing this for a long time, you can see all the indicators that liquidity is slowly leaving the markets. And people think that the Fed lowering interest rate 25 basis points is liquidity. No, that takes 18 months to work into the system. That's not money printing. That's just something that they're doing to help. Liquidity would be if they printed money and gave it to the banks. They haven't done that yet, and they can't do that until there's some sort of crisis. So I expect the Fed to react at some point, but until then, we're going to see degradation in the equity markets eventually, the credit markets, and corporate debt. And you can see it already. I mean, you know, First Brands was a warning sign. Private credit is a $1.5 to $2 trillion opaque, you know, mysterious, no one knows what's going on there kind of thing. And that's been a lot of the Ponzi finance. Banks pull back from lending to these private credit is nothing more than lending to small businesses and medium businesses that are private. The banks used to do that. They don't anymore. So they gave it to private equity, and then private equity does it. But the banks are exposed to private credit funds and private equity funds via loans to them. So they're on the hook, too.
And who's on the hook for the 11.3% defaulting CMBS paper, the commercial mortgage-backed securities? Is somebody not marking that to market? Where is that? That must be a trillion in losses.
That's correct. There's $3 trillion of that money on banks' balance sheets, and there's been a little game going on that was allowed under the Biden administration. It was called Extend and Pretend. And in November of 2024, right before Trump won, the Federal Reserve of New York put out a paper saying they're concerned because they're extending and pretending. And that is starting to that can only be hidden for so long. When you start to have other credit issues, like in the subprime, they start to feed. And then if you have a housing problem, so that housing is $12 trillion on the bank's balance sheets. It's going to come to light. It's been hidden, but it's there. It hasn't gone away. It's a disaster. And, you know, there was kind of this, like, wink, wink, nod, nod. We're going to pretend it's not there and hope that nobody notices. Well, that's still there, and it's coming to light at some point.
Yeah. Last question. What about gold and silver? It feels to me like the baton in the physical market is maybe passed over to Shanghai at this point in time.
Gold is going to be bid for years to come. We are trying to report can illustrate why. I can't give that up because that's sensitive information. But China will be buying gold for years to come. Central banks will be buying gold for years to come. Commercial banks are now buying gold because it's tier one capital and you can, you know, loan against it. Physical gold, that is, not GLD or futures. So gold had a huge move to 4,400. You know how these things work. It is ultimately still a commodity. It will will trade technically. So we're in a consolidation phase. It could be 3 months. It could be a year. Once it's done consolidating, it's on its way to, you know, I know people who are smart, who've done good technical analysis, plus the fundamentals and technicals, when you marry them together, suggests that gold's going to 10,000 by 2030, and silver will follow. So, you know, I would buy gold on dips. In any kind of financial margin call or systemic crisis, gold may go down 30, 40% due to margin calls. Buy it immediately if you can. It won't stay there long.
I agree, and it's the only financial asset I know that is not somebody else's liability, if you hold it.
Right, and again, because it's one of the problems with gating factors on gold is you got to store it, and you don't. If you do buy gold and store it on your property, don't tell anybody that you're doing it. And if you custody it somewhere, then you know and things get really wacky, and the government wants to take it, they can come to the custodian and take it. So it shouldn't be a whole big part of your wealth, but it should be a percentage of your wealth, you know, anywhere from 2 to 10%, depending upon what you want to do. I know some people are gold bugs, and that's great, but you know, the problem is you got to eventually get the gold into the system to transact. It's hard to scrape gold bars and transact.
Yeah. And I've taken my first calls in the last 6 months from Canadian clients, I would say, who want their gold out of Canada because they don't trust the government there anymore.
There's going to be trust issues all over the place. And look, we haven't had capital controls in the U.S. They're coming. They're coming. Capital controls are coming. Trust me.
What's that going to look like?
It's going to be harder to move assets from overseas to here. You're not going to be able to. You might not be allowed to take your money out of certain banks The capital controls could certainly be imposed on corporations. What they're going to try to do is make sure that capital doesn't flee from the U.S. if we get into trouble. And we might get into trouble. If we do, then you have capital controls. China has capital controls. And there's a reason they do, because everybody there would want to get their money out of the country. And some of that's been leaking. That's part of the problem, is the soft power from China is that they have vast quantities of M2. That people really need to be aware of. They hold about 43% of the money supply of the world, and it does leak out, and that finds its way into real assets and soft power. So if we allowed China and had no capital controls, and China didn't have any of their own, the money would flee and they'd be able to buy up the world, because ultimately people there know that there's a problem in China with the power structure.
Well, and they just passed a rule, kind of arcane, but they placed silver on a export list, control list. It's a sensitive material for them. So that's okay. You can still export it, but, you know, a lot of rules now. And you have to, anyway, it has to be run up the party flagpole, and somebody up high has to say okay. So that kind of gives it a little bit of a roach motel. Silver comes in easy, but it's going to be harder to get it back out again.
Yeah, and that could happen with us. Gold, they may not allow exporting your gold or silver here as well. Capital controls come in very many various forms. And basically, capital controls lower the velocity of money, which lowers economic growth. That's, unfortunately, one of the side effects.
With massive debt on the books, what could go wrong? So any closing words for people listening? Like, A, where do they follow you? But B, what should they be considering doing in terms of de-risking their portfolios right now?
Yeah, so basically you can follow me on X at Dowd Edward. Our website is financetechnologies.com with a PH. You can buy any of our economic research reports, real estate reports, U.S. economy report, and a an expansive China report, but it is more geared towards institutions and governments and hedge funds and whatnot. I also have a private website at dowd.com if you want to find me there and sign up, because I do think, you know, just because we're on Twitter and we're able to communicate, I don't think that's always going to be the case, especially if we have a new administration in 3 years. So you're going to start developing your own email list, is my humble opinion. In terms of, I've been beating the same drum. I'm not going to tell you what percentage of your wealth should be in cash, but you should have some portion of your portfolio in cash, meaning T-bills or money market funds, so that you can take advantage of the opportunities that are coming. Just like Warren Buffett, he has 5.5% of his, it's 5.5% of the T-bill market, biggest stock, cash stockpile ever. And he does because he knows what's coming and he's going to buy bargains. So I've been consulting with a lot of different people. So I have a side gig doing that. And a lot of the people that come to me are already prepared. And I tell them, look, you're ready. Just wait, relax, and buy when the opportunities come. If you're not prepared, if you're up to your eyeballs in equities and margin account leverage, you should start thinking about moving to the sidelines. And that's all I can say about that.
Understood and well said. All right. Well, Ed, thank you so much for your time, and great catching up with you here today.
Same, Chris. Always a pleasure. Take care.